Your money, your life. From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is the Business Briefing on Business Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Business Briefing. I am your host, Janet Alvarez. We're off to another exciting start this morning to talk about everything that's trending in the worlds of business and economics. We're going to have an exciting show today. Joining us will be Jeremy Schwartz, Global Chief Investment Officer at WisdomTree and host of Behind the Markets here on SiriusXM Business, to give us his show preview and talk about the general market headlines. George Glover, economics writer and insider, will be here to talk about all the latest CPI, PPI figures, the impact on the Fed and on the broader economy. We'll also be joined by Guy Adami, host of Market Call right here on SiriusXM, and CNBC analyst. We'll be talking through all of the big financials earnings that are out this morning and also to get a preview of his show. But we always kick it off talking about what's trending in the worlds of business and finance today. And to help us do so now is Linda Yu, fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and professor at the London Business School. Linda, welcome to the Business Briefing.
Good morning, Janet.
Linda, so, you know, I wanted to talk about the tech sector because the tech sector is one that's seeing a bit of a revolution happening right now due to AI. Private tech company valuations have been falling, though, in most recent rounds. A lot of big companies like Klarna and Stripe, for example, have been seeing valuations drop. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Are valuations set to fall further?
I think they are. And indeed, this has been quite a few over the past few months. Big startups, actually, that have seen declines in values of 85%. And actually, we even saw a unicorn. So this is, I'm talking about payments company Plastiq. They've declared bankruptcy. And they're not alone. Zoom, a robot pizza delivery startup that raised about $500 million from investors, including SoftBank, shut down just last month. So what we're seeing is quite a lot of pressure in terms of the valuations on these companies, but it's tipped some of them over into bankruptcy. And this is where you start to get echoes of what happened in the dot-com bubble in 2000, where you saw a number of these startups in the e-commerce space in the span of 18 months go from lofty valuations down into bankruptcy. And the whole collapse was so severe, it actually tipped the economy into a recession. Now, you know, history, as Mark Twain said, doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So I think we should be very thoughtful about looking at what's happening in the sector and whether or not these down rounds, which is how I would describe Klarna and Stripe, two companies that you mentioned, where they're raising funds, but at valuations which are significantly below what they were at their height. If this is much more normal for the sector, instead of raising money, you know, valued at, you know, billions and billions, you know, that Stripe was at $50 billion, and it's now valued at $6.5 billion. If that's actually more reflective of its fundamentals, then we don't have to repeat history, and we could find the tech sector begins to normalize. But I think on current trends, we should be watching very carefully to see if there are more bankruptcies, and importantly, whether or not it affects the investors, the creditors that have put money into these companies.
So let's talk about the down round in valuations that these companies are seeing. Is this just a hangover from the excesses of the past several years of cheap credit, of the frenzy in venture capital and in the tech sector?
Yeah, so I think those are the ingredients of a bubble. I'm sorry, I should have said that Stripe's valuations had fallen to $50 billion, so it's about half of what it was valued at before. And they are one example of many where you have had a decade of very cheap interest rates, or cheap money. And so it's not just the banks, but actually what's called the shadow banks, and that includes private equity, private credit, basically all sorts of investors who are not officially regulated as banks, have put money into very promising startups, especially in the areas which seem increasingly transformative. So, you mentioned AI, e-commerce had been booming during the pandemic, and there does seem to be some pickup in activity for those companies that are in the AI space or in the space of autonomous vehicles. So you could begin to see that down rounds are more normal, as in valuations are reflecting more what the companies are worth and not just the amount of cheap credit available to pile into a sector, and also differentiation as a result of that, because it's only the most resilient companies that survived the dot-com bust. So I'm thinking of Amazon, I'm thinking of eBay. So we could find that there's some shakeout from the sector where the companies that are pushing ahead, are able to move ahead and not only survive, but actually thrive with this market shakeout. So that's, to borrow Warren Buffett's phrase, when the ocean tide goes out, you can see who's wearing swimming trunks. I think that's a better term than some. But so you could actually find the down rounds become normal, just like in public companies. We expect public companies' valuations to go up and down. And if you do start to have, more down-to-earth valuations because money isn't so cheap, then you could did very well after a great crash because they were more fundamentally valued at appropriate rates. And importantly, those who are putting money in them were themselves highly indebted. And this is a point which often is just worth remarking, which often gets overlooked, which is if you have a lot of drops in valuations, investors had put their money in, had borrowed money to invest in these companies, expecting in the case of private equity funds, a 3x return over 10 years. So they borrowed on that basis. Now, if valuations start to fall dramatically, they may actually find themselves unable to meet their own loan obligations. So margin calls could happen, and that could actually make private credit in particular quite susceptible to drops in valuation. And that could be, and this is a big warning that's come from the Financial Stability Board, this global body that oversees systemic risk, that shadow banks, especially those exposed in the way that I've described, could actually pose a risk for the next financial crisis, precisely because they were investing valuations and borrowed money on those valuations that may not be realistic. And can they afford the amount of debt they've taken on to make those investments? I mean, in a slightly different sector, you've already seen some big investors, private investors like BlackRock, actually start taking losses on commercial real estate just to offload some assets which are falling in value. So that gives you an indication of where the sector is currently sitting, and certainly one that we should be paying attention to because it's not quite the same as it was in the dot-com era or indeed in the 1920s. But private equity, private credit, and shadow banks, this is the newest feature of a repeated story through history.
So let's talk about private equity, private credit for a moment, because, of course, higher interest rates are impacting not only upon their ability to make loans and gain returns on those loans, but also on any existing debt that they have. How concerned are you about the higher for longer stance that the Fed and other central banks around the West are taking and its impact on private equity and on the tech sector in general?
I'm quite concerned because one of the big unknowns at the moment is how long interest rates will stay higher as well as go higher. So the impact on the shadow banking system and actually on public markets are very fixated on what happens next to interest rates. And interest rates themselves are looking, I would say, a little bit uncertain because we know that the Fed is expected to increase rates again later this month. They didn't raise rates last month. So that would take the benchmark rate to about 5.25 to 5.5%. But one of the governors, Christopher Waller, actually backed a rise this month and actually another one before the end of 2023. So this is going against what the markets are currently expecting. If you look at futures markets, they expect one more rate rise from the Fed. But they expect over the next year that the Fed will actually start cutting rates down to 3.8% by November of next year. So on that basis, markets have actually been rising on the expectation that this tightening cycle actually is going to end soon. So you look at the NASDAQ up 33% this year, S&P 500 up 16.5% so far. Indicators of the markets are going to open slightly up today. There is still this belief that rates are going to come down. We're not going to see stubborn inflation for too long. Therefore, cost of capital and cost of borrowing will start to come down, especially next year. But if inflation proves to be more persistent, and Governor Waller is right, you don't get a rapid decrease in rates, that could, I think, put a lot of pressure on heavily leveraged creditors in the public and the private spheres. And I would probably say the key indicators now to look at for interest rates are actually not just core inflation, because that was what's causing a lot of the markets to expect to start to wonder if rates actually are going to come down, because even though the headline inflation rate has dropped, pretty rapidly to 3%, core inflation, which excludes food and energy, and this is the one that the Fed watches, has actually slowed more slowly. It still sits at 4.8%. That's far above the 2% target. So if core inflation stays high, and then depending on what happens to the labor market, because that's also another indicator of how resilient the economy is and therefore it affects interest rates, these two factors will impact where rates go and therefore market sentiment. So there's a lot of uncertainty, I would say, in the next couple of months, but I would watch core inflation and I would watch non-farm payrolls, of course, out in the first Friday of every month.
So it seems to me that, you know, the winners in this economic cycle, both in the financial sector and in the tech sector, are those that are obviously the best capitalized, that are the least reliant upon credit. And, you know, the rally that we saw in the first half of this year was largely concentrated in the big tech names. This would seem to indicate that that will continue to be the case. They're the best capitalized. They will thus have the lowest cost of capital, less need to raise new capital and assume debt.
Yeah, spot on. So let's just take the S&P 500. It's actually the most concentrated since the 1970s. So just like you said, seven of the biggest companies on that index, Apple, Microsoft, Google's owner, Alphabet, Amazon, NVIDIA, the chip maker, broadly computing equipment, Tesla, Meta, they have gained between 40 to 80% in the first half of this year. The rest of the 500 companies, the 493 companies in the index, are actually flat. So it's very rare to get this kind of dominance in terms of big tech companies. And just five of those actually represent a quarter of the market cap of the entire index. So it does seem as if the bigger companies, those that are sitting on cash and don't have to rely on debt, are the ones that are driving the recovery of the market and the performance. And if the rates continue to stay high, then I would expect that to continue. And you also see that filters through into the private markets, because the private markets are, in a sense, at the moment, lagging public markets, even though, some of these companies are driving the recovery of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. Private markets tend to lag by about 18 months. So even though this recovery in public markets has been pretty strong this year, albeit in a very, very specific way, private markets are still seeing, quite a lot of pressure. So by that metric, you wouldn't expect private markets actually to recover until next year. And that would coincide with a coming down of borrowing costs that would make private investment, more possible, just like it would in the public markets. So in the best case scenario, this kind of elevated borrowing costs means that the best performing companies, come out of it stronger. But in a less good scenario, of those 493 companies on the S&P 500 that are flat, there are certainly some which are actually worthy of credit, of better growth. But it's hard to differentiate when you have such uncertainty in the market. And that's also the case for private markets. So depending, as I say, on what happens with inflation, labor markets, and the core inflation rate in particular, unless there's a period in which disinflation or prices begin to come down rapidly, we could find that on the current projection, this year remains volatile for markets, because market sentiment could turn depending on what happens to these indicators. And you could find some, you know, some upward and downward movements in both private and public markets. But the trend, I think, will very much depend on what happens to the cost of capital. And that we probably won't see a fuller picture of until next year.
Linda, very quickly, just in the last 60 seconds or so, because you are based in the UK, I just wanted to ask if you have any particular insights into the UK and continental Europe, because I know rates are heading even higher there.
Yeah, very much so. So both markets at the moment are under huge pressure. Continental Europe, because of the links to Russia, adding uncertainty, even though energy prices have come down. The UK imports a lot of inflation, and the FTSE 100 has actually suffered a great deal on as a result of the higher interest rates that results from the inflation. So I would say markets here tend to lag the U.S. because rates tend to be slightly higher than the U.S. We've certainly seen that in the cycle. But I would say the other big differentiator between U.S. and European markets at the moment is that the U.S., we just discussed, big tech companies, public and private. In Europe, there's actually fewer of those. So there's fewer engines to drive a rapid recovery, a turnaround in either the FTSE 100 or the DAX or the CAC, the German and French indices. And so they, I think, are going to see a tougher market in the coming months than the U.S. on current trends.
Linda, such a pleasure to have you join us again. Please remind us where we can follow you and your work.
Thank you so much, Janet. I am at Linda Yu, that's LindaYueh, on Twitter.
Thank you again. And Linda Yu is fellow in economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and a professor at the London Business School. And joining us